You are Locked On Jets, your daily New York Jets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome to the Locked On Jets podcast on this Monday, the 14th of January, the year 2019. I'm John B. from GangreneNation.com. Busy day today, as the Jets will introduce Adam Gase formally. Press conference around 2 o'clock in Florham Park, New Jersey, at the team's official facility. They will stream it online. Some news came out over the weekend. Some good news broke on Sunday. The Jets are keeping Brant Boyer, the special teams coach, who his first 2 years were not that great, but the Jets emerged as one of the best special teams units in the league this year. I'm sure he got a nice recommendation from the folks running the team when Gase was hired, so it's good. He'll be sticking around. Jets obviously produced two Pro Bowlers this year, Jason Myers, the kicker, Andre Roberts, the return man, and Boyer will be returning. We're down to the final four in the NFL. We'll talk about those games, the divisional games from this weekend. We'll talk about them a little bit later in the show, as we'll have four offensive juggernauts, really. Four teams with dynamic offenses. And the AFC will have the Patriots and the Chiefs. And then the NFC, it'll be the Rams and the Saints in a rematch of a pretty classic game from a few months ago. And in some ways, it'll be the old guard, Brady and Breeze, on one side, and the new guard, the next generation of quarterbacks, Mahomes and Goff, on the other. But before we get to that, I'm trying to give you as many perspectives on Adam Gase as I can. We have Matt Cannata with us. Matt writes for the Finsider, the Miami Dolphins website, on SB Nation. Matt, welcome. Thanks for joining us for a few minutes today.
Not a problem. Thank you for having me.
So, Matt, why was Adam Gase fired by the Dolphins?
So, a lot of people are asking this because when he was fired, the media portrayed it as that he would have a lot of competition out there for his services. And they immediately linked him to the Cleveland Browns, which we know that they had no interest in talking to him. He interviewed with the Arizona Cardinals, also interviewed with the New York Jets, obviously, now the Jets head coach, and also took an interview with the Green Bay Packers. You look at Adam Gase and you look at his resume throughout the NFL, and really the true definition of someone who worked their way up the ladder, starting in the very early college days with Nick Saban, and then gradually progressing from there, doing several positions, and then working his way up to offensive coordinator, and then, of course, head coach. He is described as an offensive genius, as you guys all know, with all the reports and articles that have come out. And he was once compared, and still is probably compared, to a young Bill Belichick in terms of, while Bill Belichick's a mastermind on defense, Adam Gase would be the mastermind on offense. And that's who the Dolphins thought they were getting when he came to Miami. And then year one, he takes it to the playoffs, and everyone's thinking, okay, we found our coach of the future. Year two, Ryan Tannehill gets hurt again with another ACL injury. He goes down. They bring in Jay Cutler. Everyone's willing to give Adam Gase a pass and wipe away that season. That season basically did not exist in terms of evaluation and seeing what he can work with and how he can construct this roster. Year three, it fell apart. The biggest reason for him being fired, and Stephen Ross, the owner of the Dolphins, likes Adam Gase and loved him when he hired him and had to convince others in the room, actually, that Adam Gase was the answer, because several in the room were not convinced that he was. So Stephen Ross had to do his best-selling job, and he, obviously the owner, got what he wanted. But it was just a toxic environment behind the scenes. After year one, there was a real power struggle with himself, Mike Tannenbaum. Adam Gase got more power because of his playoff run, convinced Stephen Ross to give him more power. And he did, even though it was never officially public or an official title or anything. He just got more and more power. That continued to year two, continued to year three. If you look at the Dolphins' transactions and everything else and who he brought in, who he cut, those were all driven by Adam Gase. Nobody really put him in check. Tannenbaum didn't put him in check. Greer didn't put him in check. So it was basically Adam Gase's show. And by the end of year three, it was a very toxic environment behind the scenes. And then, of course, Stephen Ross made a decision at some point towards the end of this past season that what they were doing was not working. And he wanted to basically start from scratch, rebuild this team. And Adam Gase wanted no part of that. Adam Gase wanted to win now. He wanted to sign some free agents, draft a quarterback. He was set to move on from Ryan Tannehill. And he wanted to continue this thing. But Stephen Ross said, no, we're going to rebuild. And they couldn't come to an agreement on that. So it was, goodbye, Adam Gase. So that's really the kind of backstory there.
So as much as performance, it was kind of just organizational philosophy going forward, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Adam Gase's, record in Miami when he first started, 10-6, 6-10, 7-9. Yeah, there were questions about, how he was getting his team to perform, questions about, you know, them starting off slow. He's very good at in-game adjustments. Sam Darnold, he's going to make him so much better. You know, people say that with this roster, he was a miracle worker pulling off 7 wins. But, you know, it was a combination of both. But I would say more so the main reason why he's gone is because Stephen Ross, the owner, wanted to go in a different direction with a rebuild. Adam Gase did not.
Do you think that reputation as being an offensive wizard is justified?
Based on his work in Miami, no. I think that playoff run that first year actually was not good for him. Almost like in Buffalo, where they had their playoff run, Sean McDermott's first year was not good for the team because that put them way ahead of schedule. And obviously they kind of regressed this year as they worked to find their franchise quarterback. So I think that first year kind of pumped up Adam Gase's ego a little too much. He got away from what really was working for him, and he kind of started to think, okay, what I'm doing is the right way. I'm not going to change for anybody, because that first year he really started to rely on the ground game more with Jay Ajayi, started to really kind of mix up things to play to the strengths of the team. Year two, he kind of went away from that and then ended up trading Ajayi midway through the season. And then this year, he just totally went away from that and just did what he wanted to do. So I don't know that his offensive wizardry, I don't know if that's, you know, a good definition for him anymore. He's definitely going to have to reprove himself in New York. I do think if he learns from his mistakes that he made in Miami, he will be a successful head coach. But him getting a head coaching job as soon as he got fired from Miami, I don't know if that's the best way for him to really understand the mistakes that he made here in Miami.
There have been some reports out that suggest that there were issues within the locker room. There obviously were some pretty high-profile guys who were sent out of Miami by Gase who have negative things to say about him in public. To what extent were there problems, and to what extent were those problems maybe a little overblown in the media, do you think?
Yeah, so I was in the locker room twice this season, and I saw Adam Gase interact with the guys after one of their victories. And he was walking all over the room, giving high fives and just shaking everyone's hand and really in good spirits. So when the reports come out and say that he lost the entire locker room, that is just not true. There were definitely guys who had his back, who had his, best interest looking out for him. Of course, there were other guys who didn't care for him. And then we saw the exodus of players that happened under his watch, like JHI, like Jarvis Landry, Mike Pouncey, and several others, Jordan Phillips with the Buffalo Bills. And they all sounded off in one way or another. I think the most unjustified one, I think, is a mix between Jarvis Landry and Jay Ajayi. I think Jordan Phillips should not have been let go. I think people got in their feelings a little too much on the coaching staff, and which led to his release. But Jay Ajayi was a malcontent. He was basically someone who wanted to get everything for himself, was not a team player. He even after victories, if he didn't get the ball enough, if he wasn't the featured back, more than the, you know, slow down pace of change of pace back, he would get upset. And it was visible in the locker room after his first overtime win under Adam Gase's reign against the Cleveland Browns, I believe it was. Jay Ajayi actually had the winning touchdown on the run, but reports come out of the locker room saying that he was very upset after the game because he believes he should have had the ball more, and he didn't have the ball more. So he was the ultimate example of not being a team player. And while many people like to point and joke that, oh, he traded Jay Ajayi and Jay Ajayi went to go win a Super Bowl, you know, I think that's all that's unjustified. They needed to get rid of him. They got some value for him from the Eagles, and that's that.
How is Gase's game management?
I don't like Adam Gase's game management. You will notice as Jets fans and watching the Jets games, and the cameras will show it, when Adam Gase is done with the offensive drive, whether no matter what the result is, while the defense is on the field, Adam Gase will go down and sit on the bench and pay no attention to what is happening on the field. I noticed it several times in person. The cameras have showed it and became a topic of discussion this season with the team. Now you can say, okay, Andy Reid does it. Okay, Sean Payton does it. Sean McVay does it. But those guys are winning. Those guys have proven that they can do what they need to do and still have results on the other side of the ball. Adam Gase will sit on the bench with nobody around him, will not talk to the quarterback really during the split between offensive drives and defensive drives. He won't talk to any of the players. he would just sit there, look at the plays, and try to figure it out. Adam Gase is very stubborn. He's not going to give up play calling. Don't even ask him if he's going to give up play calling. He will get very upset with it. And he just kind of gets too much in the moment there and tries to rely too much on what he thinks will work rather than always getting the feel of the game. I think that was a big point for myself as well, where we didn't see him really have a feel for what was going on, mainly because and partly because he just wasn't watching the entire game and didn't understand the momentum swings and everything else. So I think he needs to work on that. If the reports are true that Greg Williams is coming as defensive coordinator, I think that will certainly help Gase as he tries to problem solve and game plan for the next offensive drive. But in terms of feel for the game, I'm not really sure he has a great feel for it.
What do you feel of the caliber of his assistant hires?
In Miami, I thought it was dreadful. And I think that's a big reason for his downfall. Year one, we saw a lot of guys coming in. We didn't know too much about them. And then kind of as you saw it play out there, you started to realize maybe these guys aren't the best. Jeremiah Washburn, for example, just came from Detroit this past offseason, but he was fired midseason in Detroit for a terrible, terrible job that their line was doing. But Adam Gase is buddies with his father, buddies with Jeremiah. So he brought him in. And you will see as he brings in assistants and so forth, he likes to bring his friends up there. And the rumors right now, Dowell Loggins is coming to be the offensive coordinator. Dowell and Adam Gase go back quite a bit, and Dowell does not bring much to the table. Adam Gase restructured his coaching staff this past season to put more people at the top underneath him and then overseeing the other coordinators and assistants. And to his reasoning was because he needed to get better efficiency and better game planning and so forth, and it didn't really translate to results. So we kind of see what's going on now, who he's trying to bring in, who he's naming as coaches, who he might bring from Miami. If he doesn't step out of his comfort zone, he's going to end up with the same results, unfortunately.
So coming from a Dolphins perspective, are you happy to see him with a division rival? Or are you upset to see him with a division rival? Are you somewhere in between the two?
I'm somewhere in between the two because, like I said at the top of the show, the interview, I do believe that he will be a successful head coach. He does have the skill set and the qualities to be a successful head coach. The only thing is he going to learn from his mistakes? And on Finsider Radio, which is our podcast, we talked about this last week. And human nature, right? You get fired from your job, but someone's calling you the next day or the same day and saying, we want to come interview you. We want you to talk to us about a possible head coaching position. You're getting three calls from three different organizations, three different teams. You're going to start thinking that, okay, maybe what I was doing was actually right and working. Maybe it's the actual organization I'm in that's not doing things the right way and their setup is not letting me succeed. So that may get to his head a little bit. And again, the quick transfer from one job to the next doesn't really give much time to reflect on what went wrong. We see the best coaches, I think, the retreads, come back after being a coordinator or a position coach for several years, having the opportunity to reflect, working under another head coach, seeing what works for them, what doesn't work for them, and then coming back and hopefully having successful results. Again, if Adam Gase can learn from his mistakes in Miami, he will certainly be a successful head coach with the New York Jets, and that's what scares me. But if he doesn't learn from his mistakes, and some things are already showing me that he hasn't learned from some of them already, I think he's just going to fall in the same trap.
All right, Matt Canada from the Finsider, thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me. Take care.
Hey, what do you know? We actually found somebody who had some decent things to say about Adam Gase. It's been a long search. I'm glad somebody could at least give us a little positivity on Gase. I know Matt still mentioned some negatives, but at least we have a few things to be optimistic about. But let's talk now about divisional weekend. We are now in the final four of the NFL. The divisional slate of games is over, and it was the home teams winning. And in all honesty, some very disappointing games on the AFC side. Two games that looked like they had the potential to be really good on paper that just ended up being duds. And we'll start with the first game of the weekend. We'll talk Colts-Chiefs, which was just really a no contest. The Colts just did not show up from the start of this game. Colts kind of looked like a team that was playing with house money. The Colts had a great season. I think any Colts fan, if you had told them you'd make the final eight and the team would look this promising, it would look like the offensive line has turned things around, Andrew Luck would be healthy and play at that level, I think any Colts fan would have taken it. This was just a situation where this game got out of hand early. Things snowballed on them. When you're in this round, you have to be able to weather the storm early in the game because the other team's going to come out really fired up. The home crowd's going to be loud. And if you're not careful, you can be run out of the building before you know what hit you. And, you know, you look at what happened to the Colts on offense early in this game. And the issue was, like, it wasn't so much that they didn't make adjustments, that they didn't have time to make adjustments because they couldn't sustain a drive. They couldn't get a first down in the first half. So you can't really make adjustments when nothing's working. You know, you have to get some sort of rhythm on offense. And it was just, they were constantly going three and out. On some early run plays, one thing I noticed, Dee Ford was making a few plays off the edge. The Colts were running a few zone reads early, and Dee Ford was crashing down off the edge on the running backs. The Colts were leaving him unblocked. And the way the zone read works is you leave the guy on the edge unblocked, and if he crashes down on the running back, the quarterback's supposed to pull the ball out and keep it and run past him. And Ford was not respecting the option the Colts had. Ford was essentially saying, Andrew Luck's not going to keep this ball and run past me. He's just going to hand it off every time. And that's exactly what happened. You look at the first half before this game got out of hand, Colts receivers just were not getting separation. It was just nobody was doing their job for the Colts. And then in the second half, they fell way behind. They were able to pin their ears back a little bit. That Chiefs defense was able to just go after Luck. And the Colts offensive line that had been stellar for so many months just had trouble protecting Luck. And Luck, I don't know, maybe he was pressing. He just couldn't get anything going. You look on the defensive side of the ball for the Colts, and I mean, this shows you the challenge any defense has going up against the Chiefs. By design, this Colts defense is kind of conservative. They're built to try and take away the big play. You're playing against Tyreek Hill. You know, you have to try and take away the big play. Well, what happens is that if you're sticking a bunch of guys deep over the top to prevent the big play, you're leaving a lot of room to operate underneath for Travis Kelce. And Pat Mahomes, to his credit, dinked and dunked. He just took what was there. And, you know, the Colts defense actually showed up in the second half. They only gave up 7 points in the second half, but by that point, it was too late. You look at special teams. Now, the Colts did block a punt in this game, but Adam Vinatieri, and I think to some pregame comments, Michelle Tafoya, right before kickoff, the NBC sideline reporter, she said, and this is something that stuck in my head. Something that stuck in my head throughout the game was the weather was not great in this game. There was snow. It was cold. And Michelle Tafoya said something to the effect of, you know, I spoke with a lot of Colts. The last one I spoke with was Adam Vinatieri. And every Colt I spoke with before Vinatieri said the weather's not going to be a factor. And Vinatieri said something to the effect of, if you say that, you're lying. And I think the weather got into his head. He misses a chip shot field goal right before the half, which was important because that ended up being an important score that the Colts did not get. And then he misses an extra point later on, which if that's the last we see of Adam Vinatieri on an NFL field, that's kind of sad because he may go down as the greatest kicker ever, the greatest clutch kicker ever, to see him miss some chip shots in a playoff game. That's, it's difficult to watch. And it kind of stole him missing that field goal, especially right before the half, was unfortunate because it kind of obscured the fact that his coach stole a possession for his team. The Chiefs were driving right before the half, and Frank Reich got really aggressive using his timeouts. And because he was aggressive, the Colts were actually able to put together a drive. They got the ball back with around 1 minute 50 seconds left in the half. Whereas if Reich had not been aggressive with his timeouts, the Chiefs would have been able to either run the clock out or run it down to maybe 30 seconds or so, and the Colts would not have been able to put together a drive. Because Reich was aggressive with his timeouts, the Colts stood a fighting chance. He essentially stole a possession by using those timeouts, and the Colts were able to take advantage, get the ball into field goal range, and Vinatieri misses the kick. This game was just a total mismatch. You got to give credit to the Chiefs. I picked the Colts in this game, but I was concerned about it because I felt like if it was a blow, I did not think the Colts could blow the Chiefs out, but I thought the Chiefs could blow the Colts out, and this thing just got away from the Colts early. I don't think there's any other way to put it. Later on Saturday, the Saturday night game, the Rams defeated the Cowboys. And, I mean, this one is kind of simple to analyze. Cowboys defense that's been really good this year just was mauled up front. The Rams controlled the game in the trenches. Todd Gurley, C.J. Anderson coming out of nowhere. I mean, geez, did you even know C.J. Anderson was with the Rams? Looking good. He's big, but, he looked good. There was one play in the fourth quarter where he made this ridiculous cut, and I didn't see. I thought it was Gurley because the cut was so good in that game. Cowboys, I don't know what happened to the Cowboys defense in this game. They just got run over in this game. And then on the other side of the ball, this is something I've been thinking about over the last 2 days. It's really tough to go on the road and win in this round when you're up against one of the top two teams in your conference. Again, you're on the road. You're the underdog. They've been rested. It's really tough if your quarterback doesn't go out and have them. You can't hide your quarterback in this game. You need your quarterback to steal a game. And I just think about some of the plays in the second half where the Rams were banged up in the secondary. And pretty much whenever Dak Prescott wanted an outside throw, it was going to be there because the Rams corners on the outside were giving such big cushions because they were, you know, they just did not trust what they had out there. They did not trust the guys that they had out there. And I think, you know, Dallas, it's always tricky in a big game because you want to stay true to your identity. But I think Dallas was a little too hesitant to go away from Zeke Elliott. And I think maybe Prescott, if Prescott had the ability to audible, maybe he should have been more aggressive. He should have taken the initiative there. We talked last week about Dak Prescott. The book's not written on him. This was another chance for him to take another step forward, kind of take the ownership of this team. And I feel like it was a missed opportunity for him. You know, I don't think he played poorly, but the Cowboys, I think, needed their quarterback to take this game onto his shoulders. I don't think that happened for them. So the Rams move on, and in spite of some bizarre game management, I mean, McVay made some really odd decisions in the fourth quarter, wasting a timeout on a fourth and goal play, trying to draw the Cowboys offside, which I don't even understand what the point of that is on a fourth and goal play. And he wasted the timeout. And then he went for it in a situation where he really should not have, where chip shot field goal puts them up two scores about halfway through the fourth quarter. And instead he goes for it, and they do score the touchdown. But the only way the Rams don't take the game over at that point is if they come away with 0 points. You know, if they get a field goal, I mean, at that point of the game, a field goal is almost as good as a touchdown. If for some reason they went for the touchdown, which was much riskier, you know, it's a much lower percentage play, but they got it anyway, and the Rams move on to the NFC Championship game. Early Sunday, the Patriots blew out the Chargers, and, you know, I had this one wrong. I thought the Chargers were going to win this game, and the Patriots go and just lay a beat down on the Los Angeles Chargers. For me, this comes down to, you know, when I was picking this game, I remarked that this Patriots team had not impressed me down the stretch, and I think there was just one thing I forgot, and that's Belichick. I thought Belichick really turn the screws on the Chargers. I thought it was a masterful game plan by Belichick. I mean, first of all, I think above all else, there was no show by the Chargers pass rush. I think the Chargers pass rush needed to show. The way to beat New England is you have to get to Brady with four pass rushers, and you have to be able to tackle in space. Those are two things that are non-negotiable. I don't understand why Tony Romo, and I love Tony Romo, I think he does a great job on CBS, but he becomes very fixated in Patriots games about the idea that you have to play man-to-man instead of zone, which, I mean, I've seen Brady pick apart man coverages a lot. The Patriots are known for their rub routes, which are classic man beaters. They are very good at work with receivers operating out of the slot who tend to be tougher to cover man to man. So I don't understand why Romo gets so fixated on the idea that you have to play man to man against the Patriots. Patriots can beat man to man coverage. What you have to do is you have to get to Brady with four pass rushers, because Brady will pick you apart if you blitz him nonstop. And you have to be able to clog the passing lanes by leaving extra defenders back, you know, make the windows tighter. And second, you have to tackle in space. You can't let guys break tackles and get to the first down sticks. So, and the Chargers just did none of that. And, you know, you talk about Belichick. I mean, Belichick outcoached Anthony Lynn. I thought Belichick's game plan was masterful on both sides of the ball. I think, you know, on the offensive side of the ball, the Patriots did a good job staying ahead of the sticks. I think part of the story was part of the reason the Chargers' pass rush was slowed down was they could never get Brady into third and long. The Patriots were just kind of moving the ball down the field steadily, and whenever they were in third down, it was third and manageable, so you never got into a situation where those great pass rushers were able to pin their ears back. And then Patriots ran the ball very effectively. They used, I think, their personnel groupings were very effective. The Chargers just constantly remained with extra defensive backs on the field. It seemed like there were a lot of situations where the Chargers were playing six defensive backs on the field, even when the Patriots were putting a tight end and a fullback on the field. Chargers needed to get those skinny guys off the field, get some guys with some muscles out there. And Patriots were able to run the ball effectively because of that. And then on the other side of the football, Belichick was very aggressive with the blitzes against Philip Rivers. Rivers is obviously not a mobile quarterback. He's not going to be able to extend plays. And, you know, I was thinking as I was watching this game, what's Philip Rivers always loved to do? What's Philip Rivers' game been? You go back to the days of Vincent Jackson and Malcolm Floyd. He likes to throw the ball up down the field, let big receivers play basketball, go up and win jump balls. And that's, you know, that's the reason the Chargers drafted Mike Williams. Mike Williams is a perfect Phillip Rivers receiver. He's a guy who made a living at Clemson, going up and getting Deshaun Watson's passes deep. You know, he just went up and won jump balls. What did Belichick do? Belichick blitzed, because when you blitz, you force the quarterback to make quick reads, especially a quarterback who's immobile, because the quarter, because he can't extend plays. He doesn't have the ability to get out on the run and buy himself extra time. So when you blitz, you force him to get the ball out quickly, and that's just not what Rivers wants to do. So I think they made Rivers uncomfortable, and the Chargers just had no answer. I think the Chargers had no answer for anything New England was doing, I think. And those are, I mean, to me, those are the things that this game came down to. Chargers didn't do what you need to do to beat the Patriots. They didn't get the, they did not get a pass rush to Brady. They were dominated up front, especially that vaunted defensive line, which is, has a lot of good players on it. And secondly, they missed too many tackles. And third, I just thought New England had a better game plan. And then the finale, which is the New England, the New Orleans Saints defeat the defending Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles. There will be a new champion this year. There will be no repeat. And before we get into this game, I just have to say hats off to the Eagles. You know, I mean, I know sometimes we're a little too quick to praise teams that lose, but for how far that team came, I mean, when you think about where that team was a month ago, it's amazing that they even made it this far. And they showed you, even though somebody else is going to win the Super Bowl, they showed you why they are champions. Making it, first of all, making it this far, and second of all, putting up this kind of a fight against the Saints. And because honestly, I thought the Saints were a vastly superior team. I mean, you look at the weapons the Saints have on this team. It occurred to me there was a little stretch, you know, in the second, third quarters where the Saints offense was really moving the ball. It seemed like they had kind of figured things out. And I noticed, like, I went online and I checked the box score, and Alvin Kamara only had 7 carries. So they have so many weapons that they can get rolling even when Alvin Kamara is not really rolling, even when they're not even utilizing Alvin Kamara. That's how many weapons they have that they can be moving the ball effectively without Kamara. And this was not a particularly well played by this game by the Saints. I thought that they missed a lot of opportunities. Breeze, I thought, missed 2 touchdown passes that he underthrew, one of which was the interception on the first play of the game. The Saints had some timely penalties. They had a touchdown wiped off by a penalty. I just think at the end of the day, they overwhelmed the Eagles. You know, I think part of it was the Eagles may have been a little worn out, because you have to remember the Eagles have essentially been playing in the playoffs for a month. They've needed to win. They needed to win their last couple regular season games to even make the postseason. Then they had to go on the road last week and win a very tough game in Chicago. Maybe they just, and they've been banked up all year. They're playing backups. Maybe they're just a little bit worn out. And I think the Saints were able to eventually wear them out. You know, one of the MVPs of this game is Mike Westhoff, the Saints special teams coach, who we remember with the Jets. How many big wins, especially in the Rex era, was one of the key plays, Westhoff special teams unit doing something big. And in this game, Saints were down early, and you know, they were really struggling. They weren't able to get anything going, and a fake punt is what turns the game around. Fake punt gets the Saints rolling. So, you know, great job as always by Mike Westhoff. He always comes through there. And ultimately, this game was tight down the stretch. Saints shot themselves in the foot on a drive where it looked like they were about to kick a field goal to put the game out of reach. They had a very shaky third down play call, which made the kick much tougher than it had to be. They missed the field goal, and here come the Eagles driving down the field with Nick Foles. Looks like they're about to pull it out. And one of the things that I was thinking during that drive, I was thinking the Eagles were going to score and win the game. And then the ball goes through Alshon Jeffrey's hands, and it's intercepted. And it's maybe, you know, one of the few times you'll see the Eagles beat themselves. I started thinking about the Eagles, and I started comparing them to New England. And you know, one of the reasons New England always wins is they don't always have the best team, but they never beat themselves. They never make the big mistakes. And I started thinking about this Eagles team, how this Eagles team just, even though they were undermanned in this game, they just did not, they were not beating themselves. And then they finally did. Finally, you know, they make a play, an unforced error that loses the game. But, you know, it's tough to hold that against them. Just a gutty effort by the Eagles. I think, you know, that's a tough venue to play. It's especially tough when the other team has a bye. And I think the Saints are just a better team this year. It's very tough to repeat in this league. I think this year the Saints are just a better team. So that sets up Championship Sunday. It'll be a week. It'll be, you know, it's less than a week now because it's Monday. So be what, 6 days away. We'll have Kansas City hosting New England. That's the late game on Sunday. We'll have the Saints hosting the Rams in the early game, which will be a rematch of a really exciting game from a few months ago. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about those matchups plenty in the days ahead. That's all for today's show. Thank you for listening. This has been the Locked On Jets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network. As always, if you like the show, subscribe. iTunes or Spotify are your two best bets if you do enjoy. And leave the show a good review in iTunes if you do enjoy it. Have a great Monday, and we'll be back again tomorrow.